Ladies and gentlemen, could we come in and get ourselves seated, please? So let us begin the plenary session for the day. I am Tony Harris, Senior Advisor at the Union, and with Dr. Saidi Egwaga, TB Programme Director for Tanzania, it is our privilege to co-chair this session. It is our great honour to introduce to you Ambassador Mark Dybul. Ambassador Dybul serves as the United States Global AIDS Coordinator, leading the implementation of President Bush's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. PEPFAR is the largest commitment by any nation to combat a single disease in living history. In addition to this hugely busy, important, and demanding position, Ambassador Dybul oversees all US government engagement in the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, and serves as the chair of the Global Fund Finance and Audit Committee. He is also chair of the UNAIDS Program Coordinating Board. Before coming to PEPFAR, Mark served on the Planning Task Force for the Emergency Plan and was the lead in the Department of Health and Human Services for President Bush's International Prevention of Mother and Child HIV Initiative. Mark holds the rank of Assistant Surgeon General and Rear Admiral in the US Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. We are delighted that Mark has found the time out of his very busy schedule to come to Paris and address the plenary session on response of health systems to MDR, XDR-TB, and also HIV-TB. Mark, we are greatly honoured to have you here with us today, and speaking on behalf of everybody in this room, we eagerly await your talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony, and good afternoon, everyone. I assume this is what I click on to get slides. Yes, there we go. Just a caveat to begin with. I'm not sure how the title MDR-XDR wound up in the program. That wasn't the what I was invited to speak on. And while I will touch on MDR-XTB, I think it's actually appropriate to talk about HIV-TB in that context, because I think, as you're all aware, we need to control HIV-TB if we're going to control MDR-XDR, and really in the context of the theme of the meeting, deal with health systems. Before I begin, I wanted to thank a number of people who were a great help in putting this presentation together. From the World Health Organization, our close collaborators, Ruben Granich, Paul Nunn, Mario Raviglione, Kevin DeCock, and from our own team, Dr. Caroline Ryan, who really is one of the most spectacular people we have in the group. She's giving 6 talks here, so you'll have a lot of opportunity to see her, and Bill Coggan. Most importantly, thank the people of the countries in which we're privileged to serve, because they're, in the end, the ones doing all the work. To put ourselves in context as we start to talk about HIV-TB, as many of you know, HIV is the largest killer of people in sub-Saharan Africa, 2 million people per year. And, of course, TB is the leading cause of death among people with HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. TB globally takes the lives of 1.6 million people, and malaria, 1 million. So you can see when you look at the numbers and what we're dealing with HIV-TB is a massive global pandemic requiring immediate response. The approach I'd like to take to this discussion is to make 3 basic points. First, successes and lessons learned from global HIV, global TB and HIV programs are actually tremendous models for health and development in general. And we probably need to spend a little more time focusing on the extraordinary work that's been done and what we've learned from them. Taking those lessons learned, we need to move towards an understanding that we have an obligation to link HIV and TB. It's not something that's a good thing to do. It's actually a requirement, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And lastly, talk about the fact that not only is it an obligation, but it's in our self-interest to link HIV and TB programs. Let's begin with successes and begin with TB, because TB programs have been implementing it for a long time. I think leading into the discussion of lessons learned, we should begin with the bigger picture, because the lessons we've learned and the programs that have been implemented for TB and HIV have not just been good health programs, they've been good development programs. And if you look at the global consensus now from the Monterey Consensus, the Paris Declaration, and recently the Accra Accord, there are four fundamental principles. And these principles are at the heart of the implementation of TB and HIV programs. Country ownership, multi-sectoral engagement, all aspects of society being involved, not just governments, a results base with accountability, set goals and then achieve them, and good governance. And these themes will underline a lot of the comments I make. If I don't specifically refer back to them, I think it's important to remember that this is the context in which we're working and in which success has been achieved. Beginning with tuberculosis, this comes from the World Health Organization. In deep red, or the other darkish colors, are where the new cases of TB were in 2006. And you can see heavy concentration in Africa, in particular in sub-Saharan Africa, also Eastern Europe, India, and parts of Asia. We'll come back to the deep focus and deep number of new infections in sub-Saharan Africa when we talk about HIV-TB. Fortunately, there's been a response to this growing epidemic of tuberculosis. In the blue line, you can see the resource enhancement or increased contribution from external sources for tuberculosis. Important to point out that countries are also contributing quite a bit on their own. And also the number related to the increase in resources of directly observed therapy or stop TB countries. Now, there's no question that there's not enough money for tuberculosis right now, and a lot more progress needs to be made, but I think it's important to highlight the fact that a great deal has been done, largely under the leadership of the World Health Organization, Stop TB, and others. This just puts it graphically the number of countries that have now launched directly observed therapy programs under Stop TB. As you can see, DOTS was launched when 73 countries had programs, and now it's more than doubled to 155. India is one of the great success stories through the DOTS program. Rather dramatic, 900 million people covered through DOTS. More than 100,000 people are put on therapy now every month. Rather extraordinary success, and you can see that exponential growth beginning in 1998 as DOTS came into play. Importantly, and this gets back to country ownership and all sectors being involved, the success is widespread across different parts of the implementing community. So while the government is heavily involved, so are medical colleges, the corporate sector, private practitioners, and non-governmental organizations, all contributing to the increase in case detection and therefore treatment. Similar picture in China. As programs have expanded, the private clinics, traditional medics, and others have been heavily engaged, bringing in the civil society, community aspects of the program. And that has contributed significantly to the success, linking the public health sector to the civil society community sector. Data from Africa is very similar. In the yellow bars, you see what happens when you have decentralized community approaches in addition to the conventional approach. When you put those pieces of programs together, you significantly increase the reach and effectiveness of programs. So TB, while there's certainly much that remains to be done, certainly more resources are needed, a great deal of work has been done, and tremendous lessons have been learned not only for global health implementation, but for good development. Shifting to HIV/AIDS, the global picture is currently around 33 million people infected with HIV/AIDS. You can see two-thirds of them, 22.5 million of them, are in sub-Saharan Africa, and that will become very important as we talk about HIV/TB. Also Central and Eastern Europe with an increasing epidemic, and Southeast Asia. So where we have HIV, we also have a lot of, where we have TB, we also have a lot of HIV. Fortunately, as with TB, there's been a tremendous response, a much larger response, even though the graphs look the same. The dollar amount is much higher here for HIV/AIDS. Currently about $10 billion per year for HIV/AIDS. That's an increase from 2000 of in the millions of dollars, not billions of dollars. So you can see this exponential growth, and you can see the Global Fund and PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, contributing. Now, I happen to know the PEPFAR program better than anything else, so I'm going to spend some time talking about that. I think it's important to note that that is about 55% or more than half of the global response to HIV. So while it's not the whole picture, it is reflective of what's going on globally. So I'll spend a little time going into detail there. The program itself is a bilateral program. It focuses on 15 countries, 12 in sub-Saharan Africa, Vietnam, Haiti, and Guyana. It's rather extraordinary. These 15 countries have half the disease in the world. It's a rather remarkable statement. But it's also a multilateral program, close working relationship with the UN family. It particular on HIV/AIDS, the World Health Organization will talk about, but also UNAIDS, UNICEF, World Food Program, and others. And also the Global Fund. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria is one of the most important global efforts to fight diseases. The United States is privileged to provide about 30% of all resources as the largest contributor, so this is both a multilateral and bilateral program. And fortunately, those dollars are achieving results, getting back to the results base of effective development and effective global health. This is what's happened with antiretroviral therapy since 2002, now reaching 3 million people globally. And as you can see in the dark blue bar at the bottom, what is driving that increase is sub-Saharan Africa. In fact, when President Bush announced PEPFAR, there were only 50,000 people in all of sub-Saharan Africa receiving antiretroviral therapy. Now in sub-Saharan Africa, we're over 2 million people on antiretroviral therapy. This increase in therapy has actually had a benefit. As you can see, we have now seen a trailing off, a decline in the death rate, a number of deaths among adults and children globally. So we're starting to see success in real opportunity, or in real benefit to people with the disease. As I mentioned, a focus on results is a critical aspect of effective development and effective global health. Now, within the PEPFAR program, we have very specific goals to support prevention for 7 million new infections, treatment of 2 million HIV-positive people, and care for 10 million, including orphans and vulnerable children. Therefore, our budget, and this, the reason I show this is because the budget is similar within the Global Fund and other large organizations, about 47% of our budget goes for treatment, 29% for prevention, and 24% for care. Now, that's not a prioritization. We all believe that prevention is the ultimate foundation of successful programs. Treatment is more expensive, which is another reason we need to have more emphasis on prevention, because by doing that, we'll reduce the burden of treatment and care. But nonetheless, as I pointed out, globally, there's been tremendous success with over 3 million people now in the developing world receiving antiretroviral therapy. What's happening in PEPFAR parallels what's happening globally. Through March of this year, the American people through PEPFAR are supporting antiretroviral therapy for more than 1.7 million globally, 1.6 million in sub-Saharan Africa alone. And if you look at those 15 focus countries, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa, there's been an 1,800%, almost 1,900% increase in services provided. Some countries, if you see Guyana, Rwanda, Botswana, Namibia, actually achieving what is considered universal access. Now, these people on antiretroviral therapy, actually the advantage is not just having people on drugs. The advantage is that they extend their lives. And through 2009, the program, the PEPFAR program by itself, and if you add then globally everyone else, will save 3.2 million life years. If you put that in context, since the United States began providing antiretroviral therapy, it's less than this number that's been achieved in the last couple of years. And that leads to real benefit to communities. In Secure the Future, a Bristol-Myers Squibb, good demonstration of multi-sectoral involvement, over a two-year period, they saw a 50% reduction in HIV mortality. And importantly, they saw nearly a 50% reduction in hospitalization occupancy. That builds capacity because you reduce the burden on the health system by 50%. In Uganda, antiretroviral therapy with a clean water program through lay healthcare workers, and we'll come back to that, reduced HIV mortality by 95%. It reduced non-HIV infant mortality by 81%. That's rather extraordinary. And the reason is probably because there was a 93% reduction in orphanhood, and we know if parents stay alive, kids have a 3 times greater chance of staying alive, regardless of the cause. And so for the first time in decades, we are seeing a turnaround in what was a disaster in public health. These are data from Botswana. After decades of declining life expectancy, 20-30% reduction in life expectancy, as HIV resources and the response started to be implemented, we're seeing for the first time an increase in life expectancy in Botswana. And for the first time, after a significant increase in child mortality, a decline in child mortality associated with increased HIV resources and programming. So the HIV dollars are having an impact on global health more broadly. The community has been absolutely essential to these successes. This is just one example. Overall, there's a lot of engagement of non-government organizations, but loss to follow-up, something directly observed therapy and the TB community already knew, is if you involve the community, you will actually reduce loss to follow-up. So in this one program, it's actually the AIDS Relief Program through the Institute of Human Virology at the University of Maryland. By engaging the community, they went from an 18% loss to follow-up rate to a 3% loss to follow-up rate, demonstrating what we already knew from DOTS, important lessons learned. Shifting to care for HIV-positive people who don't yet need treatment, and also for orphans and vulnerable children is a critical aspect of a response to HIV/AIDS. The Global Fund also supports such programs, but the data we have are nearly 7 million people in care and 2.7 million orphans and vulnerable children through September of last year. Shifting quickly to prevention, this is a good news story. There's no question we still have a long way to go, but if you look at the recent data from UNAIDS, we're seeing a leveling off of prevalence and new infections. If you look in the bottom panel in sub-Saharan Africa, we are actually seeing a decline in prevalence across the continent in the last 5 years. That's really good news. Now, we've got a long way to go. It's not acceptable to have 20 to 30% infection rates in some country, but the fact that we're leveling off and declining is good news. In the area of prevention of mother-to-child transmission, we've seen an increase in coverage from about 7% to 35%. Now, we still have a long way to go, but that type of increase in 3 years is rather dramatic. Within the context of PEPFAR, those are global numbers. Thus far, we've supported behavior change programs for 61 million people. We've supplied 1.9 billion condoms worldwide since PEPFAR began. As Peter Piot, the head of UNAIDS, has said, that's more than the rest of the world combined. Supported counseling and testing for 12.7 million women, leading to this estimated aversion of 194,000 new infections. Also importantly, safe blood programs are an important part of HIV prevention, even though they don't contribute in Africa, at least, to a lot of infections. We've seen in those 15 countries that I mentioned an increase in safe units from 52% to 75% in a four-year period. Now, I want to talk a little bit about country ownership, because that has a lot to do with how we're going to respond to the HIV-TB epidemic, in particular MDR-XTB, by, as we have pointed out, some of the critical lessons learned from HIV and TB implementation is engaging the community. Thus far, in PEPFAR, 87% of our partners are local organizations. 80% of them are non-governmental organizations. Now, we have a way to go, and that's why we're implementing some new policies and practices through partnership compacts to engage further civil society and governments and to get our larger international partners to turn over a lot of their work to local organizations. But this is how we're going to tackle the epidemic, TB and HIV, together by getting to the community level and building the communities. But we also have to build the capacity if we're going to rely on those communities, because there's a lack of a lot of capacity in many places, particularly when you get to the village level, and that's where we need to intervene for both HIV and TB. In 2007, PEPFAR supported $640 million for capacity building, supporting 2,700 service sites for care and treatment, importantly including 1,400 with significant laboratory support for CD4 cell count, blood chemistry, CBC, an increase of 42% in 1 year. The reason for that is obviously clear. We need to build laboratory capacity if we're going to tackle HIV and TB together, and we'll come back to that. There's been a lot of work to build the health system through human workforce, which is going to be essential for HIV and TB. We work closely with WHO and UNAIDS to develop task-shifting guidelines. This is something the TB community has been doing for quite a while, using the local community, as we pointed out, to allow non-physicians and non-healthcare professionals to be engaged to get to that village level. Thus far, we've supported training for 2.7 million encounters, and we support the salaries of over 110,000 healthcare workers, many in the public sector. We also know, as we know in TB, that we have to train a new cadre of doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals. So in each of our countries, we allow $6 million, or 3% of the total budget, for pre-service training of new health professionals, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and masters in public health. So far in Namibia alone, we've supported 1,000 bursaries for a new cadre of healthcare professionals. And the United States and the United Kingdom has announced an exciting new initiative targeting Ethiopia, Kenya, Mozambique, and Zambia to increase the coverage of healthcare workers, not HIV, but healthcare workers, including for TB from 1 to 1,000 to 1.7 to 1,000 in a 5-year period. This is something the G8 has endorsed and something I think we all need to focus on. As a part of that, the next phase of PEPFAR for the next 5 years has a goal of 140,000 new healthcare professionals and paraprofessionals trained. That will contribute to the overall health sector. A lot of examples from country where we're doing innovative things to support national strategies for rural retention schemes, important for HIV and TB, to bring retired people out. Sometimes in a lot of countries, 40-year-olds get retired, nurses, great experience, bring them back into the workforce, supporting new cadres of healthcare workers, clinical officers in particular in South Africa and Ethiopia. Many examples of what we're all doing together. And this isn't to be PEPFAR specific. This is an example of what needs to be done to build the healthcare workforce, not just for AIDS, but for HIV, TB, and everything else. Of course, healthcare workers aren't enough. You need a place to work. So in 33 facilities that we studied, 92% of all the new investments in infrastructure came through PEPFAR resources, buildings and renovation, lab equipment, training, and other equipment. And this building of a health infrastructure is contributing to non-HIV indicators. Family Health International did a study of 30 primary health care centers in Rwanda looking at non-HIV indicators and what happens with HIV resources. And what they found is a significant increase in family planning, antenatal visits, syphilis screening, other laboratory usage. That's because the HIV resources are building a healthcare capacity. And it doesn't take much, if you've been in the country, to understand what happens. On the left was the laboratory before HIV resources. On the right is the laboratory after. You can tell the type of lab work you're going to do one or the other. And this will be very important as we talk about HIV-TB. Same in just the waiting room. No one wants to come into a waiting room on the left. But if it looks like it does on the right, everyone will come in. This is not unique to HIV. This is HIV-TB. These are many facilities that are being renovated. Also, new building. This is a new HIV clinic that was opened in Tanzania, our co-chair's country. What this did is freed up all that space that was being taken up in the hospital, including the TB clinic, to allow for better services across the health sector. Now, one of the important pieces that we all need to work on is a health system supply chain management system. And now, for the first time through HIV resources, we have 3 nodal sites in sub-Saharan Africa, east, west, and south, to provide a continuous supply chain. And there have been no stockouts of products as a result of this. And I'm not talking about HIV. There are 120 products and commodities, including cotrimoxazole prophylaxis, including isoniazide, including TB, malaria, and other products. So we're building an infrastructure that will allow for a regular supply chain. We're also building a monitoring and evaluation system at the site level. This is an example in Ethiopia, where the Ministry of Health now knows every site in the country that's providing antiretroviral therapy and HIV services, and we need to expand this to include HIV-TB. This is actually being done at the village level through an innovative public-private partnership called Phones for Health. It's a U.S. government investment that has now spread, and we take no ownership over it. In fact, the government and people of Rwanda led the effort. We just provided the resources. It's a partnership with Voxiva, GSM, which is providing mobile phone companies who will provide the airtime for free. They are using handheld devices at the point of delivery for reporting. For the first time, ministries know what's going on in the villages, and it's national in scope. While it was begun for HIV, Rwanda has now expanded it to TB and malaria, and we're moving now out to 9 countries. An excellent example of how you can use health infrastructure to incrementally build from one program to another. This is an example from malaria, but one I think we need to do for neglected tropical diseases and tuberculosis as well. In Zambia, working with the President's Malaria Initiative, more than 500,000 bed nets were delivered in 6 weeks before the rainy season. The reason they were able to do it is because we had supported an infrastructure of home-based care and delivery to 350,000 homes. So within 6 weeks, if they're going out once a week for HIV/AIDS care, they can carry a bed net with them. Importantly, they can also do neglected tropical diseases. They can also start developing TB programs. In a similar way, through DOTS programs where people are visited in their homes, we can begin to build out HIV/AIDS programs. And that's what we need to do. And that moves us to the next piece we want to talk about, which is the obligation to link these huge successes in global health, TB programs and HIV programs together. And as I mentioned before, this is not just a good thing to do, it's an obligation. It's an obligation because TB and HIV are inextricably linked, at least in sub-Saharan Africa, and contributing to the MDR-XDR-TB problem we are having. We also know how to respond, and we're going to see some extraordinary data from a number of countries. And because we know how to do it and we know there's the problem, we have to do it and we have an obligation to do it. This is an example of HIV prevalence in TB cases, getting back to the map you saw before. You can see in the dark colors now the heavy concentration of HIV-TB in sub-Saharan Africa. And this shows more graphically what's going on. Unfortunately, when I transferred the slides, you lost some of the data. But what you see are in established market economies in the upper left and in other parts of Asia and countries where we don't have a heavy link of HIV-TB, we've actually seen declines in TB cases. But if you look in sub-Saharan Africa, which is the lower left, especially where there's a lot of HIV, we've seen a marked increase in TB cases. Same in the former Soviet Union in the upper right panel. So as we're seeing an increase in the TB epidemic, we can link it directly in sub-Saharan Africa to HIV-TB. Now, why is this happening? I think most everyone in the room knows TB is the leading cause of death among people living with HIV/AIDS, and it is one of the most opportunistic infections. The reason for this occurring makes a fair amount of sense because people with TB are more susceptible to TB because their immune system is weakened. And people with tuberculosis, unfortunately, also have weakened immune systems and so we believe are more susceptible to HIV as well. So there's a vicious cycle with the two epidemics feeding off of each other. This has come home to roost to some degree as we talk about XDR and MDR-TB. As many of you know, MDR and XDR is not a new phenomenon. It has existed for 20 years in many places, and you can see the countries, 35 countries where it exists. What's concerning are those three dots, which should actually now be four or five dots, because just in the last month, Namibia has reported cases of XDR-TB. What we're seeing is a new epidemic of XDR-MDR-TB closely associated with HIV/AIDS. There was a survey done in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa looking at 119 TB patients with antiretroviral therapy. There were 14 deaths. 10 of them had MDR-TB, and 6 of the 10 of them were resistant to first- and second-line drugs. Because of that, a more in-depth analysis was done, and what was found was rather frightening and was the cause of a lot of public discussion. And that is, of the 542 cases evaluated, 53, or 10% of all the cases, had XDR-TB, and 24% of them had MDR-TB. When you looked at the XDR-TB cases, they studied 44 of them to see whether or not the patients had HIV. All 44 of the people evaluated for HIV with XDR-TB had HIV, and 52 of 53 of them died. So you can see this close nexus between XDR-TB and HIV, and that is of great concern looking forward. Now, why is this happening? Well, this slide, which Caroline Ryan created, talks about a perfect storm, which is rather unfortunate. We have an introduction of second-line TB drugs into low- and middle-income countries, suboptimal TB control practices, high HIV prevalence, and high TB burden. You put all that together, and we're going to have a big problem. So how do we respond? Well, the most effective response is to effectively combat tuberculosis through DOTS and reducing MDR-TB and other innovative approaches, and TB infection control. The best thing to do is prevent new infections of tuberculosis, but then we also need to respond to those people who have tuberculosis. In the end, MDR and XDR-TB is not a de novo phenomenon. It's a symptom of a failed tuberculosis response. So the more effective TB response we have, the more effectively we'll respond to XDR-TB. Similarly, if we effectively combat HIV, prevention, care, and treatment will decrease the number of people who have HIV and therefore are more susceptible to TB. And if we treat people with HIV, we'll have a more effective response, which I'll show in a moment. And then, of course, we need to link the programs together. These data come from a very impressive study on the impact of just antiretroviral therapy on new tuberculosis cases. People with antiretroviral therapy generally have increased CD4 cell counts, a more competent immune response, and therefore are better able to handle opportunistic infections. And what we saw in this evaluation by Lawn et al. Is a 60%, more than 60% reduction in the cases of new tuberculosis among HIV-positive people when antiretroviral therapy was introduced. So simply by introducing effective antiretroviral therapy, we can begin to combat tuberculosis. And of course, if we prevent HIV infections, we can also combat HIV, but we are tuberculosis. But we need to do more than that. This slide comes from Mario Raviglione at Stop TB, and it just shows how we combine the national TB program, NTP, and the National AIDS program schematically, but more than schematically, to actually work together to begin to implement from the national to intermediate to district level, and importantly to the primary care service level and the integral engagement of the community, getting back to what we've talked about. If we don't engage civil society in the community, we cannot effectively respond. As part of this response, the World Health Organization has launched the three I's: increased case detection, isoniazid preventive treatment, and infection control. I would also add in there CPT, or cotrimoxazole preventive therapy, which is important in multiple areas for tuberculosis, but also for HIV. Fortunately, we've seen some progress. You see a nice graph showing a significant increase in HIV testing for TB patients, because if you don't identify the patients, you can't do much. But unfortunately, while the graphs show a nice slope, we're still only at 12% coverage. We've seen an increase in treatment for HIV-positive people with tuberculosis in terms of antiretroviral therapy, which, as we just talked about, will help decrease the burden of tuberculosis by simply decreasing new cases. Unfortunately, while the slope looks good again, we're still only at 41% coverage. This slide is particularly disturbing, looking because those just show increases in programs where you actually have a pool where your denominator are the TB patients you've identified. This shows patients screened for TB, diagnosed for TB, and started on IPT. And in the small percents, less than 1% at the top for screened tuberculosis and started on IPT, is the total percent of estimated TB patients in a country that are covered. So while those slopes look very good, we're less than 1% coverage in the countries in terms of people estimated to have tuberculosis. So we have a long way to go, and we need to work together. Now, one of the problems we've been having is there's a lot of debate, and I actually believe it's not a healthy debate, on which model to pursue. Do you have a program where HIV refers to TB program and TB refers to HIV? Do you have partial integration of the programs? Do you have one-stop service sites where you do HIV-TB in the same site? There are some countries doing each. Mozambique and Tanzania are doing the first approach. Kenya is using the last approach. Zambia is doing the middle approach, as is Rwanda and Tanzania. As is often the case, we're getting spun up in a lot of meetings about what's the right approach. The right approach is the most effective approach, and the right approach is what the countries pursue. So we should pursue what will be effective and get on with implementing and stop talking about the theory of what we ought to do. That's my only editorializing for the moment. Some of the lessons learned from these programs so far is routine screening for tuberculosis is essential, that we can't do voluntary testing, that we need what is effectively opt-out testing, and that we need to begin cotrimoxazole isoniazid therapy before antiretroviral therapy begins. One of our biggest problems is clinicians treating TB-HIV are not aware of the HIV infection, the resurgence of HIV when TB begins treatment. There's a lot of misunderstanding in the community about the interaction between HIV-TB. And we also still need some studies. While we have had some success, there are still a number of unanswered questions, and we can get to some of those in the questions and answer session. Importantly, TB infection control is not something that's focused on very much in countries, and without that, we're never going to catch up. Just like we can never treat our way out of the HIV epidemic, we can't treat our way out of TB or HIV-TB. We've got to prevent new infections. The United States is trying to respond, as is the global community. Again, I know our program better, so I'll talk a little bit about that. We've increased our contribution to HIV, direct HIV activities, from about $18 million 3 years ago to what will be $160 million this year. huge increase, still probably could do better. And so far, we've supported care for 367,000 HIV-TB co-infected persons. Some success is being seen, and we have, through an initiative where PEPFAR is collaborating with the World Health Organization, we targeted three countries to work together under that model where you combine the national TB and national HIV programs and see what we could do. And the results over a couple of years are extraordinary. In Rwanda, more than 88% of TB patients are now tested for HIV. That's almost a doubling. 61% of co-infected patients are receiving clotrimoxazole preventive therapy, and 36% of TB patients who are HIV positive have access to antiretroviral therapy. These are more than doublings over a three-year period, and compare these numbers to the abysmal numbers I showed you a little bit earlier. In Kenya, there was an increase from 41% to 84% in the uptake of uptake of HIV testing among TB patients, an increase of CoTrim uptake from 39 to 90%, and ART uptake from 19 to 28%. In Ethiopia, CoTrim and antiretroviral therapy for co-infected patients is rolling out. Now, one of the reasons these programs have been a success is because we're working collaboratively and internationally. The World Health Organization and the Gates Foundation have funded and brought together more than 20 countries to have lessons learned on these programs, look at these numbers, see what's working, and try to increase them. Let me show you some of the more exciting data from Rwanda. This is an increase in cotrimoxazole and antiretroviral therapy and testing in a three-year period. They went from 48% to 89% tested. HIV-positive people who were identified, you know, going down is actually a good thing because that means you're testing more people. You're not concentrating your pool. And importantly, the patients on cotrimoxazole preventive therapy, which is good for HIV but also TB and spread of TB, went from 8% to 61%. And the number of people receiving antiretroviral therapy went away. This is a matter of 4 years. This is what can be done when we work together. Importantly, task shifting was employed in Rwanda, bringing in the community so that it's not just physicians and a physician-based approach. And what we saw was a massive decrease in green of the time physicians had available for other services by engaging the community. And what happened when we involved the local community, you actually increase the capacity of the health sector when you engage the community. Those physicians can now deal with more severe cases. As I mentioned, the Global Fund is an important part of all this, and the United States is privileged to provide about 30% of resources, which means 30% of every TB and TB-HIV grant comes as part of PEPFAR. So far, the Global Fund's committed $1.4 billion to tuberculosis. Again, we've got a ways to go, but that's pretty impressive. We also support the Stop TB partnership, both for advocacy and also technical support, so countries can get through the Green Light Committee faster. I want to talk briefly about laboratory strengthening, because this is a critical piece of where we need to go. If you don't have laboratories, you can't diagnose tuberculosis, and you certainly can't begin to understand your MDR-XDR-TB problems. I'm not going to go through all these specific topics. I just want to emphasize that in six countries, we are working together to strengthen the lab capacity. And part of that is expanding rapid surveys of XDR-TB, epidemiological investigation to identify the extent of drug resistance, using renovated wards to get people out of the community so they're not coughing on each other and spreading the infection. Working with WHO on new guidance, linking infection control to larger occupational health, and training a new cadre to focus on HIV-TB. We're also expanding the monitoring and evaluation of TB and HIV, and therefore XDR-TB with WHO and UNAIDS. And again, I'll go back to that Phones for Health initiative. If we can get handheld devices into the village level, we can not only identify HIV-TB, we can identify early on when we're starting to see something unusual, like patients dying with HIV-TB, and focus rapidly in a rapid response to possible XDR-TB. Finally, on infection control, as I mentioned, has been a problem throughout the continent, and it's unfortunately not something people focus on early. Without effective infection control, all the other things we do are not going to work. And so what's happening now is a new approach to try to ventilate and properly deal with health facilities, but also train people so that the healthcare workforce can solve problems. So in conclusion, HIV and TB, it's an understatement to say they're associated. These are epidemics fueling each other in sub-Saharan Africa. And especially with the emergence of XDR-TB, what we know is we are failing, despite our good responses, in good HIV-TB responses, or XDR-TB would not be emerging. Progress is being made, but we're still a long way to go. And we need antiretroviral therapy, CPT, and the three I's. And most importantly, we need greater collaboration between the TB and HIV communities in that schematic from Mario that I showed. The HIV community, I think, needs to take much greater responsibility and role in the TB-HIV effort, and that's why I'm so pleased to be here. I'm going to end with this slide, because not only is this a massive human catastrophe with millions of people dying and with a risk of a spread of a pandemic that will kill everyone, and therefore we're obligated to act, it's in our self-interest to act. With the increased financial challenges in the world, resources for developmental issues are going to become harder and harder to come by. If we can't link HIV and TB, two things that are so closely connected, how are we going to link health interventions with education and economic development and clean water? We're not going to be able to if we can't do it on HIV-TB. And if we can't come together in responses to our challenges in health and development, if we can't show greater effectiveness, if we can't show that we're working together in a response, we are not going to be able to get resources. And so it's in our self-interest, but I hope that's not why we do it. I hope the reason that we do it is because we're obligated to, because where people are suffering and dying, it is our job to intervene to support the countries to save their lives. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Mark Daibul, for that moving presentation and for reminding us once again that we need to work together as a team and move forward to provide services to the people, patients who need it. We have 20 minutes. We are going to take questions. Please stand on the microphones are available. 1, 2, 3. Questions?
While we're waiting for people to come to microphone, let me just ask a question. Thank you very much, Mark, for a great, inspiring talk. When PEPFAR started, I'm focusing on antiretroviral treatment, it had a target of 2 million people being placed on treatment. And I think at the time that was absolutely appropriate because there were so few people. I think there's now a concern about retention on treatment and whether, in fact, that should be quite a key target that we aim for. It's no good just putting people on if actually at the end of the day only 50% are actually retained on treatment.
I think that's an excellent point, Tony, and one I know you're very familiar with in Malawi. We're seeing 15 to 30% in general loss to follow-up in clinics. Now, I think it's important to note, too, that that doesn't mean people are fudging numbers. When we report people in treatment, it's the number of people currently in treatment. So people aren't counting people who were in and then are out. But still, it's a huge issue. It actually gets to the point of a new generation of how we evaluate things, moving from outputs to outcomes, and one of them has got to be quality of services, including loss to follow-up. And so Caroline Ryan, actually, and some folks in our office, within our office, are focused on this next generation of indicators. But most importantly, we're working as a global community on that next generation of indicators with the World Health Organization, UNAIDS, the Global Fund, World Bank, and others. So we absolutely need to be focused on and evaluating that. And actually, systems are being built to look at it. Some HIVQOL and some other quality systems are starting. That's one of the advantages of this. We're actually putting in for the first time quality assessments and follows. It also points to the essential need of civil society and communities. The data over and over and over again show that if all you're using is the public health infrastructure or the medical infrastructure, you are going to lose people. You have got to link the community for the follow-up when they leave the center. And we need to be innovative. You know, people are using handheld devices and cell phones to remind people when to take their drugs, to follow people when they don't come back to clinic. And that's why it was so impressive to see some of those data. And I showed you the data from one of the programs across 9 countries of loss to follow-up going from 18% to 3%. With community engagement. And we see that over and over and over again. Some of it's been published. So we do need to focus on better indicators that focus on outcomes, not only for this, but for everything. And then we also need to make sure we're engaging the community and the health sector is fully engaged with civil society, or we're not going to solve the problem. We'll just know what the problem is and won't do anything to solve it.
Thank you. I think we have, I'll start with Diana, Peter, and Sydney.
You can tell it's a closed community when the moderator knows the names of all the...
Well, at least we have a new person on the podium that's different, right? I'm Diana Weil from the WHO Stop TB Department, and obviously our collaboration with PEPFAR is incredibly important and growing and very exciting to us today, and we hope that the future is bright on that front. I have a question related to what do you think you're learning in the AIDS community on drug-resistant surveillance and where you're going with antiviral resistance and what we can learn from TB and how that links to laboratory strengthening, some of the other things that we're doing, adherence support and things to ensure that resistance doesn't become an overwhelming problem in HIV as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a critical point, and it gets, you know, MDR-TB and multi-drug-resistant HIV are expected outcomes of programs because we know that a certain percent of people will develop resistance. You won't get any resistance if no one's treated. So actually it's a sign of success that you're starting to get some of these problems, but it's also a sign of failure. And that gets back to what needs to be done, not only to monitor and evaluate, because the laboratory and understanding there's a problem is only part of the issue. You've got to solve it, and that means you have to have the programming behind the evaluation. We are seeing gross underestimates of the amount of resistance, and the reason for that is we don't have a lot of resistance testing. We probably will not have clinical resistance testing for HIV for 10 years. It's just too difficult to establish. What we have is clinical monitoring for resistance and then sentinel surveillance to try to give us a sense of what the problem is. Right now in our clinical programs, we're seeing 3% resistant per year. There's no way it's only 3%. We're assuming it's 10 to 15%. The other problem with HIV, as in TB, is when you're doing clinical monitoring, by the time you pick up someone as resistant, their CD4 cell count dropped or they're clinically ill, and they've lost pretty much every drug in their regimen, unlike here in Paris or in the United States, where we'll pick it up early and be able to switch drugs out. So we need to be awfully careful here. We could be back in 20 years where we were 5 years ago because our drugs won't be effective anymore. So it's a combination of surveillance and building the lab capacity. It's probably going to have to be sentinel surveillance for a while. And I think we can learn a lot from each other by building these nodal clinics, which we're working on together, to build clinics that can do multi-drug resistant HIV and TB together, and extremely drug resistant TB in the same also, and to build that laboratory capacity on, at the moment, a national level. It'd be good if we could get to regional level, but there are a lot of complexities with that, as you know. We've got to have the programs to fix it.
Thank you. Peter.
Thanks, Heidi, and thanks, Mark, for a whirlwind tour of what's going on with US government support and the broad TB-HIV agenda. I just wanted to ask your thoughts and ask what PEPFAR is doing to emphasize that community engagement that you started to discuss with Tony with regard to adherence follow-up. We know for tuberculosis control that there are very large numbers of tuberculosis patients out there in communities who have minimal interaction with the health system. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, we've just conducted surveys as part of the CREATE consortium with ZAMSTAR that show that as many as 50% of the people who are identified as TB suspects in the community haven't been to the health center with that. And unless we engage in case finding both for tuberculosis and for HIV beyond where Mario Raviglione's diagram stops, which is at the sort of primary healthcare level, unless we get well beyond that, actually into villages and communities to find cases and start people on treatment, both for HIV and for TB, I think we'll lose an awful lot of opportunity for interrupting transmission. And I just wondered where PEPFAR was going with that step.
Well, first of all, I think you're exactly right. And I would point out that Mario's slide didn't end with primary healthcare. Beneath that, it had community involvement for the same reason. We've got to get to the communities. There are two parts to the solution, really. One is to get the health system further out to the village level. And a couple of countries are working hard on that, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Zambia. So part of the problem is to rebuild that health infrastructure to get it to the village level, to get it to the community level. But it's still not far enough down, and that's where you get to the community workers to get into And it's not just having someone present. Community workers tend to have, and civil society, have more credibility and reach and are able to get into the home. 80% of our partners are non-governmental organizations, and the vast majority of them are community-based organizations. And so what we're trying to do is to get them into the community level. And a great example is that malaria example I showed, where there were 350,000 households reached on a weekly basis by a community worker that was doing HIV palliative care or orphan care. So that's how we could deliver the bed nets. We need to be doing the same with tuberculosis and HIV-TB. And it's both for care but also for monitoring. And that's the advantage of those handheld devices. If those people are going out into the homes and seeing, are you coughing? Are you losing weight? You can feed those systems back in. So it's a combination of extending the health system, linking it to the communities, and then having the evaluation systems go deeply down. Now, there are a lot of promising starts, but that's all they are. They're promising starts. This is hard work, and funding of these organizations is very complicated. We're trying to set up new systems of umbrella organizations who can manage the managerial pieces and accounting pieces so that the organizations can do their work. And to be honest, I don't think we've gotten to the point where a lot of governments, including our own, is comfortable getting to that level. And it's going to be a hard slog, but we've got to do it. So it's a problem. People are working on it. I think the more HIV and TB is linked and we take advantage of the infrastructure that's been built for each to be add on to, the better off we're going to be. But it's going to take a lot of time. But I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, it is important that Mario's slide did talk about the community. That's why I emphasized the community in each of those Stop TB programs and the HIV programs. But we have a long way to go. It's not a success story yet. It's a good start.
Thank you. Stine?
Thank you very much for your very detailed and elaborate presentation. And thanks to PEPFAR for the work that they have managed to assist countries to achieve. However, the achievements that have been made is partly because of availing the resources to the countries that need them. And these resources, some of them are in Global Fund. Is there something that Global Fund can learn from PEPFAR systems, especially because if you look at the TB world, there's very little money that is trickling from Global Fund to the countries which need these monies, perhaps because of some strange reason? Is it that countries do not have the capacity to write Global Fund proposals the way Global Fund wants these proposals to be written?
Thank you for the question. I mean, as I mentioned, I think that we believe the Global Fund is one of the more important institutions in not only health but development. And it's very much driven by country ownership. So the country coordinating mechanism comes forward with the proposals. As I mentioned, the Global Fund has about $1.4 billion dedicated to TB right now. Doesn't mean it's all dispersed, but the grants have been committed. I think we can all learn from each other, and it has to do with how you put the pieces together. What we fundamentally need to be doing, and again, we have a long way to go, but I think we've made a lot of progress, is to put all of the external folks together in support of a national strategy. If you don't have a national strategy, it's not going to work. So you need a national TB strategy, national HIV strategy, a national education strategy. You've got to have national strategies that then each piece can come in and support. And while there's been, Rwanda does this beautifully, but and so do a number of other countries, but we've got to get further along in that to get back to those principles of country ownership. I think the most important thing to do is to work at that country level, particularly with the CCMs, to build the programs that are needed, because in the end, the Global Fund only funds what comes from the country to be funded. And thank you for your words on PEPFAR. I just say it's the American people that we should thank. PEPFAR is an emanation of that, but it's a great privilege for us. We believe this is an extraordinary opportunity for there to be a partnership between people. And that's an extraordinarily important thing. It increases respect and concern for each other both ways, where people understand the American people better and we understand others better, and it brings people together. And if we can do that, then I have a lot of hope, and I believe firmly we can solve not only TB, HIV, but a lot of other important issues. So thank you for that. Okay.
In the interest of time, I think we should take at least one, two, three questions. I know Alice there. We'll come back to you. Let us first take three questions at a row, and then we request Ambassador Mark Daibu to respond.
Renee Ritson from the Gates Foundation. Thank you, Mark, for your talk. Ambassador Daibu, I was wondering if you could just give us some of your thoughts about how PEPFAR is approaching the very challenging job of integrating national AIDS programs and national TB programs. I know PEPFAR is rather country-specific in how they approach or let the countries decide how they approach the treatment issues, but are there any overarching policies or thoughts that you have about PEPFAR and overcoming this challenge?
Thank you, Mark. First of all, let me extend the welcome to the inner sanctum of the tuberculosis community. And the question I have is, wanted to give you an opportunity to say more about operational research, which is going to be very much part of the newly enacted authorization in tuberculosis after so many years of a dry spell. We're sitting on new compounds that look very promising. We're sitting on new diagnostics, as well as I just saw some results yesterday of an 8-year trial in Dar es Salaam with Dartmouth University, showing some promising results of a BCG primed vaccine. So given that reality, we're just chomping at the bit to scale up our capacity to do the programmatically relevant research that will make such labor-intensive efforts easier on this community, because what we now have is very difficult to sustain over the years that it's required. So I wanted to give you an opportunity in that context to say some more about what PEPFAR 2 will be doing on behalf of operational research. Thank you.
Tidu von Schenangerer from Médecins Sans Frontières. You already mentioned that as we go along, there will be more and more patients that will be drug resistant and need a second line generation and in terms of antiretrovirals. And we already see that this means a huge cost increase as these drugs are more expensive. And we're unlikely to see the same kind of generic competition as we had before, given that there's much more patent protection in some of the generic producing countries. So what are you going to do to make sure that as we go along, your funding will not eaten up more and more by increasing drug costs, but really be there to keep as many as possible patients on treatment? Thank you.
Thank you. Before you respond, Ambassador, can I take the last two since they have been standing for the last 10 minutes?
Thanks very much, Saidi. And thanks, Mark, particularly for your leadership in making sure at PEPFAR to making sure that TB is integrated to the global HIV response. My name is Alistair Reid. I'm the HIV-TB advisor at UNAIDS. And I'd just like to hear how you would answer to the critics, that the increasingly vocal critics that say that single disease organizations like UNAIDS should, perhaps their time is up, and that we should move away from disease-specific funding and into a more health sector-wide, health systems-wide investment. Thanks very much.
Jane Carter from the USAID-AMPATH partnership in Eldoret, Kenya. This is actually just an invitation. Tomorrow afternoon, it's the last session, the last two lectures. The USAID-AMPATH partnership is going to be talking about our home-based counseling and testing, really the attempt to carry this integrated prevention messages door to door as a model.
Thank you. Ambassador Makdaibu.
Thanks. And I should point out that our biggest implementing agencies are USAID and CDC, and so we had comments from each of them, and they're doing a great job. It's the PEPFAR-AMPATH partnership that was just mentioned about that USAID is implementing. Let me try to run through each of them. Some of them are related. In terms of integrating and what we're trying to do, we've actually made money available for TB that hasn't been used, for HIV-TB, that the countries haven't then stepped forward to use, which has told us there's not enough integration on the ground, and I don't think we have enough expertise on the ground related to TB. So we're trying to provide more guidance and to work with more to get that expertise on the ground so that people can come forward with proposals. It's related to the Global Fund question, too. If there's not the expertise and the thought on the ground, you're never going to have a Global Fund proposal either. So we're open to anyone's thoughts on how to do it, because, to be honest, it's been a little frustrating when we make money available and people don't come forward with proposals. Which is somewhat related to operations research. Ken, what you talked about is not something we're ever going to do. We don't do evaluations of new diagnostics and new drugs. That's NIH, CDC, and others' work. We implement. So if products are shown to be effective, then we will use them. But what we do need to do is what we're calling public health evaluation, which is how do you use how do you improve your programs? What big questions can we ask in a 6 month to 1 year period that will change the way we do things? And we have a system in place now to do that in a more coherent way. We've got a ways to go, but we're trying to do that. And that engaged, there actually is a new approach to monitoring and evaluation for tuberculosis, as you know, that we're going to pursue. But the drugs and diagnostics isn't something we're ever going to get engaged in. That's not operations research. That's new product evaluation. But when they've gotten to the point where they've been approved for use, then we can put them into use, and then there can be operational questions around how to use them. But we can't do anything until they get to that point, which is somewhat related to the products. Our policy has always been that we will supply products at the lowest cost as long as they're high quality. And so about 70% of all our antiretrovirals right now are generic products, 90% of them through our supply chain management system. And where we're not using generics, it's generally because they're either more expensive than the innovator products or they're not available in some pediatric and second-line version. So we will continue that policy going forward and aggressively pursue it because we think as long as a drug is safe and effective and usable in that country, we should be using the lowest-cost product regardless of what it is. We actually have a public-private partnership working on this topic, and Caroline actually just mentioned me, and I think it's a good idea. We did actually support and pursued, and our approval process was the first to approve the pediatric 3-in-1 combination, something Caroline just mentioned is maybe we ought to start looking in that partnership at tuberculosis as well, combination tuberculosis products. But it's very much a high priority for us. In terms of how we deal with vertical horizontal, I have to say I think there's been a big shift because it's such a silly debate. And the more we talk about those types of things, the more we're going to lose support. I mean, we're in a tough economic situation. The more we talk about things as if they're competing against each other in what I consider to be silly ways, we're all going to lose out. Disease-specific programs build health systems, and I just showed you an awful lot of that. Health systems that didn't exist before are being created in a way that has never been seen at the village level, and that is leading to an improvement in non-HIV and non-TB care. What we need to do more of is see how we connect the dots of develop. How do you incrementally add on to an HIV or TB program other aspects? Malaria and neglected tropical disease, education, clean water, economic development. But that requires us to all break down an awful lot of bureaucratic walls. It's not an issue of vertical horizontal theoretically. It's often a bureaucratic issue of siloed groups that don't want to talk to each other or find it very difficult to talk to each other. So I don't think it's an issue of disease-specific funding or anything. It's a disease. It's a disease of bureaucracies that we can't put these things together, and that's our responsibility. And that gets back to the last slide, which is it is in our self-interest as well as our obligation to start putting these programs together and move past these debates, which are lovely in capitals but don't do much on the ground.
Thank you very much for that nice and lively response. I want to thank everybody for the lively session and the Ambassador Mark Daibu for being with us today and enlightening on TB-HIV collaboration. Thank you very much. Thank you.